move away from the art to the political?
I mean, I know when I visited the Mogao Caves, it appears that for foreigners visiting the caves, part of the tour is a stop in a separate building documenting the Western countries' purchasing and taking of the Mogao's manuscripts and cave art at the turn of the 20th century. I mean, we know that in the case of the British, they purchased from the monk in charge of the caves at the time the world's oldest printed book, the Diamond Sutra. They had examples of an American explorer also purchasing some old Buddhist manuscripts, as well as physically lifting some of the cave art out of the caves. I guess in that period, why were Westerners so interested in the Mogao Caves, and how did they even know about it to go out there?
Yeah, great questions. So the first visitors, in fact, were not the first visitors were before 1900, and they were typically involved in exploration and surveying. And this has to do with what was called the Great Game, the machinations between the United Kingdom and Russia, the Russian Empire, to control Central Asia. And so it was through that process that Central Asia began to be known. And while we have these military and quasi-military figures in Central Asia, they discovered the first sort of striking discovery was something called the Bauer Manuscript. And this manuscript was a shock, because here in Central Asia, we find a birch bark manuscript from the 4th to 6th centuries in what's called hybrid Sanskrit, hybrid Buddhist Sanskrit, or kind of Prakrit. And before, nobody ever thought that we would find these types of materials. And what it means is that this Indian civilization in many ways reached into Central Asia. And this got people very excited.
Yeah.
Because number one, because these materials don't exist in India for the most part, because the climate's much too moist.
Okay.
But so what happens is, after the discovery of that manuscript, you began to have so-called scholar explorers come in, and archaeologists, and R.L. Stein is a perfect example of this, of that combination, come in and begin to do surveys and archaeological surveys of Central Asia. And so it was during this period that they began to get word of this great Buddhist site, and also a site with lots of manuscripts,
and that got
them very, very excited.
Based on the fact that the tours with Westerners in Dunhuang make it a point to recount this history of the Western explorers and the purchasing of many of the manuscripts, is China making any efforts to get these manuscripts back? I mean, especially the Diamond Sutra?
Not on a large basis. I mean, so what we have is we have a lot of scholars working together, Chinese scholars with, say, British scholars or French scholars, on an increasingly large basis, and also museums and institutions working together. And so what we find now is that on the scholarly end of things, a lot of these materials have been digitized by the International Dunhuang Project. And this it's a remarkable project for the amount of material, and it's based out of the British Library, and they in the process over the years gotten a number of other institutions on board, and the Chinese, also the French, the Russians, the Germans, to begin to digitize their materials, manuscripts and paintings. So this is one thing that has sort of lessened the desperation for return finds, because scholars have access to the materials worldwide now. Regarding so-called plunderers, R.L. Stein is often labeled that, but as you mentioned, he actually purchased the manuscripts. Of course, that's controversial, but also there was Langdon Warner, who is from your alma mater, and he's notorious for having used a technique which he thought was innovative to basically use tape, simplifying it, to put on the murals and rip them off.
Okay.
And in the process, some were damaged, but he actually has a receipt for these. So Harvard's response will be, for example, we have a receipt. They were paid for. We bought them in good order.
It's all very legal.
It's all very legal, exactly. You know, people might disagree with the methods, and the authorities he spoke to actually purchase the material. So, of course, there's a lot of room for debate on this issue.
And I think, like, in a talk you gave previously, you had mentioned that the abbot had tried to get the Qing dynasty and the emperor interested in it. Could you just talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, Wang Yuan Lu is the person who was renovating the cave site around the year 1900 when he discovered the cache of manuscripts. And it's a fantastic cache of manuscripts. He recognized that, you know, they were important, but it wasn't. He wanted to get in touch with the authorities in order to know what to do with these manuscripts. And in fact, the Qing Dynasty authorities weren't that interested. And part of the slow response of the Chinese government at the time was that it was dominated by Confucian elites, and they saw Buddhist materials as simply not that interesting. Right. So this is one reason I believe that the process was slowed down for the Chinese government to recognize the value of this incredible find.
And just to, like, fast forward a bit in time, there, like, when you go to the Mogao Caves, you still see a tremendous amount of art on the walls. You see a tremendous amount of the carvings. How are these cave arts able to survive the Cultural Revolution, as well as the campaign against the Four Olds that sought to destroy a lot of Buddhist art?
Well, Mogao and Dunhuang was fortunate because they had a powerful patron, if you will, Zhou Enlai, Premier Zhou Enlai. And he was hugely supportive of the renovation project, the project to stabilize the cliff face, to begin a catalog process, and also research in general. And so he specifically said that Mogao Caves were not to be damaged. And I have to put in a plug here also for the Dunhuang Research Academy and the people there who'd been scholars there who'd been working on the materials for literally dozens of years at that point, that they made a serious effort to talk to Red Guards to discuss the value of the materials there. So.
And what about today? What's being done to preserve the caves, and will preservation be successful, especially as more tourists come to Dunhuang?
Right. So part of the problem with the caves today is that moisture and also carbon dioxide is beginning to deteriorate the caves. There's also groundwater coming up because there's a lot of irrigation to make pretty gardens, if you will, in front of the attraction, and so that water is seeping up into the caves. So the lower levels of caves, you can, at the bottom of the murals, they're beginning to completely deteriorate. So what's been done over the last 3 decades is that the Getty Conservation Institute has gotten involved, the Getty Museum in L.A., and that's since 1985. So it's been their longest-running project of conservation, heritage conservation. And so they've been instrumental at working with the Dunhuang Research Academy and also the Chinese government in creating, number one, an analysis, a very detailed analysis of the materials involved in the construction of the caves, how they deteriorate, why they deteriorate, and ways to prevent it. On top of that, there's also a digitization project going on. And part of that is to, along with the visitor center that recently opened, is to have to provide tourists with an alternative experience,
right?
So through the visualization the immersive visualization and of the caves themselves at the visitor center, and then to decrease the number of visitors actually going in the caves.
No, the visitor center is very, very impressive and a lot of fun, and which leads me to think that they're hoping that a lot more people come to visit it. For people who aren't China people, China scholars, what do you think is the significant? What's the significance of these caves? Like, why should just regular Americans, when they take a trip to China, why should they go out to Dunhuang?
Well, so the caves, which span in their creation 1,000 years, are the largest repository of Chinese art. And maintain and contain items and designs and styles, aesthetics, and also the very space itself that doesn't exist anywhere else in China. So in terms of this kind of immersive experience, you can't get better than Dunhuang to see how people experience Buddhism in the Tang, for example, period. So that's a major reason. And, you know, Dunhuang itself and the Mogao Caves, the site is stunning. And it gives you a sense of what the power of trade that unfolded over 1,000 years on the Silk Roads, or Silk Route, if you will. And this was the caves themselves have a cosmopolitanism. Dunhuang at that time, we know from manuscripts, was incredibly mixed and well integrated. And so there's a fascination with that as well.
Yeah. So. Finally, can you describe your favorite cave and why it's your favorite cave? You have to have a favorite.
Okay.
You can't love them all.
Well, so in spite of its formulaic nature, there's a cave 98, which is remarkable. It's quite large. It's a large family cave. It's an elite cave. But it also, what's fascinating for me, is it's well preserved, but it also lays out the political nature of the caves, the political nature of Buddhism also. And so you have large donor portraits of the king of Khotan and his relations to the Dunhuang elite. And it's remarkable for that reason that, you know, here we have a sort of detailed outline of the political alliances that were being constructed and set in a ritual space, which is a cave, in this sort of liturgical moment, again, that's in some ways frozen in time. And that's what these caves do, right? So they maintain relationships both among people and also with the Buddha forever and ever. And I find that fascinating. And Cave 98 is particularly rich in the historical political elements.
Okay, well, thank you again, Dr. Schmid, for your enlightening explanation of the Morgao Caves, and hopefully more people will go there but not breathe on the caves. So thank you.
Thank you very much.